Fantastic Audio presents The Other Wind by Ursula K. Le Guin, performed by Scott Brick, Gabrielle DeCure, Harlan Ellison, Robert Foxworth, and Jean Smart.
Chapter 1. Mending the Green Pitcher. Sails long and white as swan's wings carried the ship Farflyer through summer air, down the bay from the armed cliffs toward Gaunt Port. She glided into the still water landward of the jetty, so sure and graceful a creature of the wind that a couple of townsmen fishing off the old quay cheered her in, waving to the crewmen and the one passenger standing in the prow. He was a thin man with a thin pack and an old black cloak, probably a sorcerer or small tradesman, nobody important. The two fishermen watched the bustle on the dock and the ship's deck as she made ready to unload her cargo, and only glanced at the passenger with a bit of curiosity when, as he left the ship, one of the sailors made a gesture behind his back, thumb and first and last finger of the left hand all pointed at him. "May you never come back." He hesitated on the pier, shouldered his pack, and set off into the streets of Gaunt Port. They were busy streets, and he got at once into the fish market, a brawl with hawkers and hagglers, paving stones glittering with fish scales and brine. If he had a way, he soon lost it among the carts and stalls and crowds and the cold stares of dead fish. A tall old woman turned from the stall where she had been insulting the freshness of the herring and the veracity of the fishwife. Seeing her glaring at him, the stranger said unwisely,
"Would you have the kindness to tell me the way I should go for Ray Alby?"
"Why, go drown yourself in pig slop for a start," said the tall woman, and strode off, leaving the stranger wilted and dismayed. But the fishwife, seeing a chance to seize the high moral ground, blared out,
"Ray Alby, is it? Ray Alby you want, man? Well, speak up, then. The old major's house, that would be what you'd want at Ray Alby, yes, it would. So you go out by the corner there, and up Elvis Lane there, see, till you reach the tower."
Once he was out of the market, broad streets led him uphill and past the massive watchtower to a town gate. Two stone dragons, large as life, guarded it, teeth the length of his forearm, stone eyes glaring blindly out over the town and the bay. A lounging guard told him, "Just turn left at the top of the road, and he'd be in Ray Alby."
"And keep on through the village for the old mage's house," the guard said.
So he went, trudging up the road, which was pretty steep, looking up as he went to the steeper slopes and far peak of Gaunt Mountain that overhung its island like a cloud. It was a long road and a hot day. He soon had his black cloak off, and went on bareheaded in his shirt sleeves, but he had not thought to find water or buy food in the town, or had been too shy to, maybe, for he was not a man familiar with cities or at ease with strangers. After several long miles, he caught up to a cart which he had seen far up the dusty way for a long time, as a dark blot in a white blot of dust. It creaked and squeaked along, at the pace of a pair of small oxen that looked as old, wrinkled, and unhopeful as tortoises. He greeted the carter, who resembled the oxen. The carter said nothing, but blinked. "Might there be a spring of water up the road?" the stranger asked. The carter slowly shook his head. After a long time he said, "No." A while later he said, "There ain't." They all plodded along. Discouraged, the stranger found it hard to go any faster than the oxen, about a mile an hour, maybe. He became aware that the carter was wordlessly reaching something out to him, a big clay jug wrapped round with wicker. He took it, and finding it very heavy, drank his fill of the water, leaving it scarcely lighter when he passed it back with his thanks.
"Climb on," said the carter after a while.
"Oh, thanks, I'll walk. How far might it be to Ray Alby?" The wheels creaked. The oxen heaved deep sighs, first one, then the other. Their dusty hides smelled sweet in the hot sunlight.
10 mile, the carter said.
He thought and said,
Or 12.
After a while he said,
No less.
I'd better walk on then, said the stranger. Refreshed by the water, he was able to get ahead of the oxen, and they and the cart and the carter were a good way behind him when he heard the carter speak again.
Going to the old mage's house, he said.
If it was a question, it seemed to need no answer. The traveler walked on. When he started up the road, it had still lain in the vast shadow of the mountain, but when he turned left to the little village he took to be Ray Albi, the sun was blazing in the western sky, and under it the sea lay white as steel. There were scattered small houses, a small dusty square, a fountain with one thin stream of water falling. He made for that, drank from his hands again and again, put his head under the stream, rubbed cool water through his hair, and let it run down his arms, and sat for a while on the stone rim of the fountain, observed in attentive silence by 2 dirty little boys and a dirty little girl.
He ain't the farrier, one of the boys said.
The traveler combed his wet hair back with his fingers.
He'll be going to the old mage's house, said the girl. Stupid.
Rawr,
said the boy, drawing his face into a horrible lopsided grimace by pulling at it with one hand while he clawed the air with the other.
You watch it, Stony, said the other boy.
Take you there, said the girl to the traveler.
Thanks, he said, and stood up wearily.
Got no staff, see? Said one boy, and the other said, Never said he did.
Both watched with sullen eyes as the stranger followed the girl out of the village to a path that led north through rocky pastures that dropped down steep to the left. The sun glared on the sea. His eyes dazzled, and the high horizon and the blowing wind made him dizzy. The child was a little hopping shadow ahead of him. He stopped.
Come on,
she said, but she too stopped. He came up to her on the path.
There, she said.
He saw a wooden house near the cliff's edge, still some way ahead.
I ain't afraid, the girl said. I fetch their eggs lots of times for Stony's dad to carry to market. Once she gave me peaches, at the old lady. Stony says I stole 'em, but I never. Go on, she ain't there, neither of 'em is.
She stood still, pointing to the house. Nobody's there?
Well, the old man is. Old Hawk, he is.
The traveler went on. The child stood watching him till he went round the corner of the house.
2 goats stared down at the stranger from a steep fenced field. A scatter of hens and half-grown chicks pecked and conversed softly in the long grass under peach and plum trees. A man was standing on a short ladder against the trunk of one of the trees. His head was in the leaves, and the traveler could see only his bare brown legs.
Hello, the traveler said, and after a while said it again, a bit louder.
The leaves shook, and the man came briskly down the ladder. He carried a handful of plums, and when he got off the ladder, he battered away a couple of bees drawn by the juice. He came forward, a short, straight-backed man, gray hair tied back from a handsome, time-worn face. He looked to be 70 or so. Old scars, 4 white seams, ran from his left cheekbone down to the jaw. His gaze was clear, direct, intense.
They're ripe,
he said.
So they'll be even better tomorrow.
He held out his handful of little yellow plums.
Lord Sparrowhawk,
the stranger said huskily.
Archmage.
The old man gave a curt nod of acknowledgement.
Come into the shade,
he said. The stranger followed him and did what he was told. He sat down on a wooden bench in the shade of the gnarled tree nearest the house. He accepted the plums, now rinsed and served in a wicker basket. He ate one, then another, then a third. Questioned, he admitted that he had eaten nothing that day. He sat while the master of the house went into it, coming out presently with bread and cheese and half an onion. The guest ate the bread and cheese and onion, and drank the cup of cold water his host brought him. The host ate plums to keep him company.
"You look tired. How far have you come?"
"From Roke." The old man's expression was hard to read. He said only, "I wouldn't have guessed that." "I'm from town, Lord. I went from town to Roke, and there the Lord Patner told me I should come here, to you."
"Why?"
It was a formidable gaze.
"Because you walked across the dark land living."
The stranger's husky voice died away. The old man picked up the words.
"And came to the far shores of the day." "Yes, but that was spoken in prophecy of the coming of our king, Labanon."
"You were with him, Lord."
"I was, and he gained his kingdom there. But I left mine there, so don't call me by any title. Hawk, or Sparrowhawk, as you please. And how shall I call you?"
The man murmured his use name, Alder. Food and drink and shade and sitting down had clearly eased him, but he still looked exhausted. He had a weary sadness in him. His face was full of it. The old man had spoken to him with a hard edge in his voice, but that was gone when he said, "Let's put off talking for a bit. You've sailed near 1,000 miles and walked 15 uphill, and I've got to water the beans and the lettuce and all since my wife and daughter left the garden in my charge. So rest a while. We can talk in the cool of the evening, or the cool of the morning. There's seldom as much hurry as I used to think there was." When he came back by half an hour later, his guest was flat on his back asleep in the cool grass under the peach trees. The man who had been Archmage of Earthsea stopped with a bucket in one hand and a hoe in the other and looked down at the sleeping stranger. "Alder," he said under his breath. "What's the trouble you bring with you, Alder?" It seemed to him that if he wanted to know the man's true name, he would know it only by thinking, by putting his mind to it, as he might have done when he was a mage. But he did not know it, and thinking would not give it to him, and he was not a mage. He knew nothing about this Alder, and must wait to be told.
"Never trouble trouble," he told himself, and went on to water the beans.
As soon as the sun's light was cut off by a low rock wall that ran along the top of the cliff near the house, the cool of the shadow roused the sleeper. He sat up with a shiver, then stood up, a bit stiff and bewildered, with grass seed in his hair. Seeing his host filling buckets at the well and lugging them to the garden, he went to help him. 3 or 4 more ought to do it," said the ex-archmage, doling out water to the roots of a row of young cabbages. The smell of wet dirt was pleasant in the dry, warm air. The westering light came golden and broken over the ground. They sat on a long bench beside the house door to see the sun go down. Sparrowhawk had brought out a bottle and 2 squat, thick cups of greenish glass. "My wife's son's wine," he said. "From Oak Farm in Middle Valley. A good year, 7 years back." It was a flinty red wine that warmed Alder right through. The sun set in calm clarity. The wind was down. Birds in the orchard trees made a few closing remarks. Alder had been amazed when he learned from the master patterner of Roke that the archmage, Sparrowhawk, that man of legend, who had brought the king home from the realm of death and then flown off on a dragon's back, was still alive. "Alive," said the patterner, "and living on his home island, Gaunt." "I tell you what not many know," the patterner had said, "for I think you need to know it, and I think you will keep his secret." "But then he is still archmage," Alder had said with a kind of joy. For it had been a puzzle and concern to all men of the art that the wise men of Roke Island, the school and center of magery in the archipelago, had not in all the years of King Labannon's rule named an archmage to replace Sparrowhawk. No, the patterner had said, he is not a mage at all. The patterner had told him a little of how Sparrowhawk had lost his power, and why, and Alder had had time to ponder it all. But still, here, in the presence of this man who had spoken with dragons, and brought back the ring of Aerith Akby, and crossed the kingdom of the dead, and ruled the archipelago before the king, all those stories and songs were in his mind. Even as he saw him old, content with his garden, with no power in him or about him but that of a soul made by a long life of thought and action, he still saw a great mage. And so it troubled him considerably that Sparrowhawk had a wife. A wife, a daughter, a stepson. Mages had no family. A common sorcerer like Alder might marry or might not, but the men of true power were celibate. Alder could imagine this man riding a dragon. That was easy enough, but to think of him as a husband and father was another matter. He couldn't manage it. He tried. He asked, "Your wife? She's with her son, then?" Sparrowhawk came back from far away. His eyes had been on the western gulfs. "No," he said. "She's in Havnor, with the king." After a while, coming all the way back, he added, "He went there with our daughter just after the long dance. Labannon sent for them to take counsel. Maybe on the same matter that brings you here to me. We'll see. But the truth is, I'm tired this evening and not much disposed to weighing heavy matters. And you look tired, too. So, a bowl of soup, maybe, and another glass of wine, and sleep, and we'll talk in the morning." "All with pleasure, Lord," Alder said, "but for the sleep. That's what I fear." It took the old man a while to register this, but then he said, "You fear to sleep?"
"Dreams."
"Ah." A keen glance from the dark eyes under eyebrows grown tangled and half gray. "You had a good nap there in the grass, I think. The sweetest sleep I've had since I left Roke Island. I'm grateful to you for that boon, Lord. Maybe it will return tonight. But if not, I struggle with my dream and cry out and wake and am a burden to anyone near me. I'll sleep outside, if you permit." Sparrowhawk nodded. "It'll be a pleasant night," he said. It was a pleasant night. Cool, the sea wind mild from the south, the stars of summer whitening all the sky except where the broad, dark summit of the mountain loomed. Alder put down the pallet and sheepskin his host gave him in the grass where he had slept before. Sparrowhawk lay in the little western alcove of the house. He had slept there as a boy when it was Ogion's house, and he was Ogion's prentice in wizardry. Tehanu had slept there these last 15 years since she had been his daughter. With her and Tanar gone, when he lay in his and Tanar's bed in the dark back corner of the single room, he felt his solitude. So he had taken to sleeping in the alcove. He liked the narrow cot built out from the thick house wall of timbers right under the window. He slept well there.
But this night he did not. Before midnight, wakened by a cry, voices outside, he leaped up and went to the door. It was only Alder struggling with nightmare amid sleepy protests from the henhouse. Alder shouted in the thick voice of dream and then woke, starting up in panic and distress. He begged his host's pardon and said he would sit up a while under the stars. Sparrowhawk went back to bed. He was not wakened again by Alder, but he had a bad dream of his own. He was standing by a wall of stone near the top of a long hillside of dry, gray grass that ran down from dimness into the dark. He knew he had been there before, had stood there before, but he did not know when or what place it was. Someone was standing on the other side of the wall, the downhill side, not far away. He could not see the face, only that it was a tall man, cloaked. He knew that he knew him. The man spoke to him using his true name. He said, "You will soon be here, Ged." Cold to the bone, he sat up, staring to see the space of the house about him, to draw its reality around him like a blanket. He looked out the window at the stars, and the cold came into his heart then. They were not the stars of summer, beloved, familiar, the cart, the falcon, the dancers, the heart of the swan. They were other stars, the small, still stars of the dry land that never rise or set. He had known their names once, when he knew the names of things. "Avert!" he said aloud, and made the gesture to turn away misfortune that he had learned when he was 10 years old. His gaze went to the open doorway of the house, the corner behind the door, where he thought to see darkness taking shape, clotting together and rising up. But his gesture, though it had no power, woke him. The shadows behind the door were only shadows. The stars out the window were the stars of Earthsea, paling in the first reflection of the dawn. He sat, holding his sheepskin up round his shoulders, watching those stars fade as they dropped west, watching the growing brightness, the colors of light, the play and change of coming day. There was a grief in him, he did not know why, a pain and yearning as for something dear and lost, forever lost. He was used to that. He had held much dear and lost much. But this sadness was so great, it did not seem to be his own. He felt a sadness at the very heart of things, a grief even in the coming of the light. It clung to him from his dream and stayed with him when he got up. He lit a little fire in the big hearth and went to the peach tree and the hen house to gather breakfast. Alder came in from the path that ran north along the cliff top. He had gone for a walk at first light, he said. He looked jaded, and Sparrowhawk was struck again by the sadness in his face, which echoed the deep aftermood of his own dream. They had a cup of the warmed barley gruel the country people of Gaunt drink, a boiled egg, a peach. They ate by the hearth, for the morning air in the shadow of the mountain was too cold for sitting outdoors. Sparrowhawk looked after his livestock, fed the chickens, scattered grain for doves, let the goats into the pasture. When he came back, they sat again on the bench in the dooryard. The sun was not over the mountain yet, but the air had grown dry and warm. "Now tell me what brings you here, Alder. But since you came by Rook, tell me first if things are well in the great house."
"I did not enter it, my lord."
"Ah."
A neutral tone, but a sharp glance. "I was only in the imminent grove." "Ah, a neutral tone, a neutral glance. Is the patterner well?" "He told me, 'Carry my love and honor to my lord, and say to him, I wish we walked in the grove together as we used to do.'" Sparrowhawk smiled a little sadly. After a while he said, "So. But he sent you to me with more to say than that, I think. I will try to be brief. Man, we have all day before us, and I like a story told from the beginning." So Alder told him his story from the beginning. He was a witch's son, born in the town of Eleni on Town, the Isle of the Harpers. Town is at the southern end of the Sea of Ea, not far from where Salea lay before the sea whelmed it. That was the ancient heart of Earthsea. All those islands had states and cities, kings and wizards, when Havnor was a land of feuding tribesmen and Gaunt a wilderness ruled by bears. People born on Ea or Abea, Enlad or Town, though they may be a ditch digger's daughter or a witch's son, consider themselves to be descendants of the elder mages, sharing the lineage of the warriors who died in the dark years for Queen Alfaran. Therefore they often have a fine courtesy of manner,
though sometimes an undue haughtiness, and a generous, uncalculating turn of mind and speech, a way of soaring above mere fact and prose, which those whose minds stay close to merchandise distrust. Kites without strings, say the rich men of Havnor of such people, but they do not say it in the hearing of the king, Libanon, of the house of Enlad. The best harps in Earthsea are made on town, and there are schools of music there, and many famous singers of the lays and deeds were born or learned their art there. Eleni, however, is just a market town in the hills, with no music about it, Alder said. And his mother was a poor woman, though not, as he put it, hungry poor. She had a birthmark, a red stain from the right eyebrow and ear clear down over her shoulder. Many women and men with such a blemish or difference about them become witches or sorcerers perforce. Marked for it, people say. Blackberry learned spells and could do the most ordinary kind of witchery. She had no real gift for it, but she had a way about her that was almost as good as the gift itself. She made a living and trained her son as well as she could, and saved enough to prentice him to the sorcerer who gave him his true name. Of his father, Alder said nothing. He knew nothing. Blackberry had never spoken of him. Though seldom celibate, witches seldom kept company more than a night or two with any man, and it was a rare thing for a witch to marry a man. Far more often two of them lived their lives together, and that was called witch marriage or she-troth. A witch's child then had a mother or two mothers, but no father. That went without saying, and Sparrowhawk asked nothing on that score. But he asked about Alder's training. The sorcerer Gannett had taught Alder the few words he knew of the true speech, and some spells of finding and illusion, at which Alder had shown, he said, no talent at all. But Gannett took enough interest in the boy to discover his true gift. Alder was a mender. He could rejoin. He could make whole. A broken tool, a knife blade, or an axle snapped, a pottery bowl shattered. He could bring the fragments back together without joint or seam or weakness. So his master sent him about seeking various spells of mending, which he found mostly among witches of the island, and he worked with them and by himself to learn to mend. That is a kind of healing, Sparrowhawk said. No small gift, nor easy craft. It was a joy to me, Alder said with a shadow of a smile in his face, working out the spells and finding sometimes how to use one of the true words in the work. To put back together a barrel that's dried, the staves all fallen in from the hoops. That's a real pleasure, seeing it build up again and swell out in the right curve and stand there on its bottom, ready for the wine. There was a harper from Maeoni, a great harper. Oh, he played like a storm on the high hills, like a tempest on the sea. He was hard on the harp strings, twanging and pulling them in the passion of his art, so they'd break at the very height and flight of the music. And so he hired me to be there near him when he played. And when he broke a string, I'd mend it quick as the note itself, and he'd play on. Sparrowhawk nodded with the warmth of a fellow professional talking shop. "Have you mended glass?" he asked. "I have, but it's a long, nasty job," Alder said, "with all the tiny little bits and speckles glass goes to." "But a big hole in the heel of a stocking can be worse," Sparrowhawk said, and they discussed mending for a while longer before Alder returned to his story. He had become a mender then, a sorcerer with a modest practice and a local reputation for his gift. When he was about 30, he went to the principal city of the island, Maeoni, with the harper who was playing for a wedding there. A woman sought him out in their lodging, a young woman, not trained as a witch, but she had a gift, she said, the same as his, and wanted him to teach her. And indeed, she had a greater gift than his. Though she knew not a word of the old speech, she could put a smashed jug back together, or mend a frayed-out rope just with the movements of her hands, and a wordless song she sang under her breath. And she had healed broken limbs of animals and people, which Alder had never dared try to do. So rather than his teaching her, they put their skills together and taught each other more than either had ever known. She came back to Eleni and lived with Alder's mother, Blackberry, who taught her various useful appearances and effects and ways of impressing customers, if not much actual witch knowledge. Lily was her name, and Lily and Alder worked together there and in all the hill towns nearby as their reputation grew. "And I came to love her," Alder said. His voice had changed when he began to speak of her, losing its hesitancy, growing urgent and musical. Her hair was dark, but with a shining of red gold in it, he said. There was no way he could hide his love from her, and she knew it, and returned it. Whether she was a witch now or not, she said she did not care. She said the two of them were born to be together, in their work and in their life. She loved him, and would be married to him. So they were married, and lived in very great happiness for a year, and half a second year. Nothing was wrong at all, until the time came for the child to be born, Alder said. But it was late, and then very late. The midwives tried to bring on the birth with herbs and spells, but it was as if the child would not let her bear it. It would not be separated from her. It would not be born. And it was not born. It took her with it. After a while, he said, "We had great joy. I see that. And my sorrow was in that degree." The old man nodded. "I could bear it," Alder said. "You know how it is. There was not much reason to be living that I could see, but I could bear it." "Yes. But in the winter, 2 months after her death, there was a dream came to me. She was in the dream." "Tell it." "I stood on a hillside, along the top of the hill, and running down the slope was a wall, low, like a boundary wall between sheep pastures. She was standing across the wall from me, below it. It was darker there." Sparrowhawk nodded once. His face had gone rock hard. "She was calling to me. I heard her voice saying my name, and I went to her. I knew she was dead. I knew it in the dream, but I was glad to go. I couldn't see her clear, and I went to her to see her, to be with her. And she reached out across the wall. It was no higher than my heart. I had thought she might have the child with her, but she did not. She was reaching her hands out to me, and so I reached out to her, and we took each other's hands. You touched. I wanted to go to her, but I could not cross the wall. My legs would not move. I tried to draw her to me, and she wanted to come. It seemed as if she could, but the wall was there between us. We couldn't get over it. So she leaned across to me and kissed my mouth and said my name. And she said, 'Set me free.' I thought if I called her by her true name, maybe I could free her, bring her across that wall. And I said, 'Come with me, Mevra.' But she said, 'That's not my name, Hara. That's not my name anymore.' And she let go my hands, though I tried to hold her. She cried, 'Set me free, Hara.' but she was going down into the dark. It was all dark down that hillside below the wall. I called her name and her use name and all the dear names I had had for her, but she went on away. So then I woke. Sparrowhawk gazed long and keenly at his visitor. "You gave me your name, Hara," he said. Alder looked a little stunned and took a couple of long breaths, but he looked up with desolate courage. "Who could I better trust it with?" he said. Sparrowhawk thanked him gravely. "I will try to deserve your trust," he said. "Tell me, do you know what that place is, that wall?" I did not know it then. Now I know. You have crossed it. Yes, I've been on that hill, and crossed the wall by the power and art I used to have. And I've gone down to the cities of the dead, and spoken to men I had known living, and sometimes they answered me. But Hara, you are the first man I ever knew or heard of among all the great mages in the lore of Roke or Palm or the Enlides who ever touched, who ever kissed his love across that wall. Alder sat with his head bowed and his hands clenched. Will you tell me, what was her touch like? Were her hands warm? Was she cold air and shadow, or like a living woman? Forgive my questions. I wish I could answer them, my lord. On Roke, the summoner asked the same, but I can't answer truly. My longing for her was so great, I wished so much. It could be I wished her to be as she was in life, but I don't know. In dream, not all things are clear. In dream, no. But I never heard of any man coming to the wall in dream. It is a place a wizard may seek to come to if he must, if he's learned the way and has the power. But without the knowledge and the power, only the dying can... And then he broke off, remembering his dream of the night before. I took it for a dream, Alder said. It troubled me, but I cherished it. It was like a harrow on my heart's ground to think of it, and yet I held to that pain, held it close to me. I wanted it. I hoped to dream again.
Did you?
Yes. I dreamed again.
He looked unseeing into the blue gulf of air and ocean west of where they sat. Low and faint across the tranquil sea lay the sunlit hills of Camber. Behind them the sun was breaking bright over the mountain's northern shoulder. It was 9 days after the first dream. I was in that same place, but high up on the hill. I saw the wall below me across the slope, and I ran down the hill, calling out her name, sure of seeing her. There was someone there. But when I came close, I saw it wasn't Lily. It was a man, and he was stooping at the wall as if he was repairing it. I said to him, "Where is she? Where is Lily?" He didn't answer or look up. I saw what he was doing. He wasn't working to mend the wall, but to unbuild it, prying with his fingers at a great stone. The stone never moved, and he said, "Help me, Hara." Then I saw that it was my teacher, Gannett, who named me. He has been dead these 5 years. He kept prying and straining at the stone with his fingers and said my name again. "Help me, set me free." and he stood up and reached out to me across the wall as she had done and caught my hand. But his hand burned. With fire or with cold, I don't know, but the touch of it burned me so that I pulled away, and the pain and fear of it woke me from the dream. He held his hand out as he spoke, showing a darkness on the back and palm like an old bruise. "I've learned not to let them touch me," he said in a low voice. Ged looked at Alder's mouth. There was a darkening across his lips, too. "Ara, you've been in mortal danger," he said, also softly. "There is more." Forcing his voice against silence, Alder went on with his story. The next night, when he slept again, he found himself on that dim hill and saw the wall that dropped down from the hilltop across the slope. He went down towards it, hoping to find his wife there. I didn't care if she couldn't cross it, if I couldn't, so long as I could see her and talk to her, he said. But if she was there, he never saw her among all the others, for as he came closer to the wall, he saw a crowd of shadowy people on the other side, some clear and some dim, some he seemed to know and others he did not know. And all of them reached out their hands to him as he approached and called him by his name. "Hara, let us come with you. Hara, set us free." It's a terrible thing to hear one's true name called by strangers, Alder said. And it's a terrible thing to be called by the dead. He tried to turn and climb back up the hill away from the wall, but his legs had the awful weakness of dream and would not carry him. He fell to his knees to keep himself from being drawn down to the wall and called out for help, though there was no one to help him. And so he woke in terror. Since then, every night that he slept deeply, he found himself standing on the hill in the dry gray grass above the wall, and the dead would crowd thick and shadowy below it, pleading and crying to him, calling his name. "I wake," he said, "and I'm in my own room. I'm not there, on that hillside. But I know they are, and I have to sleep. I try to wake often and to sleep in daylight when I can, but I have to sleep at last. And then I am there, and they are there, and I can't go up the hill. If I move, it's always downhill, towards the wall. Sometimes I can turn my back to them, but then I think I hear Lily among them crying to me. And I turn to look for her, and they reach out to me." He looked down at his hands gripping each other. "What am I to do?" he said. Sparrowhawk said nothing. After a long time, Alder said, "The harper I told you of was good friend to me. After a while, he saw there was something amiss, and when I told him that I couldn't sleep for fear of my dreams of the dead, he urged me and helped me to take ship's passage to Ea, to speak to a gray wizard there." He meant a man trained in school on Roke. "As soon as that wizard heard what my dreams were, he said I must go to Roke." "What is his name?"
"Beryl. He serves the Prince of Ea, who is Lord of the Isle of Town."
The old man nodded.
"He had no help to give me," he said, "but his word was as good as gold to the ship's master. So I went on the water again. That was a long journey, coasting clear round Havnor and down the inmost sea. I thought maybe being on the water, far from town, always farther, I might leave the dream behind me. The wizard on Ea called that place in my dream the Dry Land, and I thought maybe I'd be going away from it, going on the sea. But every night, I was there on the hillside, and more than once in the night as time went on. Twice, or three times, or every time my eyes close, I'm on the hill, and the wall below me, and the voices calling me. So I'm like a man crazy with the pain of a wound, who can find peace only in sleep, but the sleep is my torment, with the pain and anguish of the wretched dead all crowding at the wall, and my fear of them. The sailors soon began to shun him, he said, at night because he cried out and woke them with his miserable awakenings, and in daylight because they thought there was a curse on him or a gebeth in him. And no relief for you on Roke? In the grove, Alder said, and his face changed entirely when he said the word. Sparrowhawk's face had the same look for a moment. The master patterner took me there, under those trees, and I could sleep. Even at night, I could sleep. In daylight, if the sun's on me, it was like that in the afternoon, yesterday, here. If the warmth of the sun's on me and the red of the sun shines through my eyelids, I don't fear to dream. But in the grove, there was no fear at all, and I could love the night again.